It was last week when it happened. Chicago police were asked to come to the aid of immigration agents trapped by a mob, an angry, violent leftist mob, and they called for help. A few came, but it was all confusion. Now, I'm surprised that it happened, but I know that our next guest would not have let it happen. Were he superintendent of police, he would have knocked down the doors himself. Our guest this week is the former police superintendent of Chicago, Gary McCarthy. Gary is currently chief of police of Willow Springs Police Department, right on the southwest side of the city. He's got a new show, Wearing the Badge, that I highly recommend. And he's our guest on the Chicago 8 podcast.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago way.
The Chicago way. That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
We're talking to Gary McCarthy, former Chicago police superintendent, currently chief of the Willow Springs Department, police department, to get some common sense into all this. Gary?
You know, John, these things happen so quickly, and it can be very confusing. But the short story is that the politics has got to stay out of policing. Yeah. This is my own personal opinion. I've been dealing with it for a very long time. You know, as I look back, it's almost amazing when I think about the fact that at one point I worked 2 years for Rudy Giuliani, 5 years for Mike Bloomberg, 5 years for Cory Booker, and 5 years for Rahm Emanuel. I mean, that's like the Mount Rushmore of mayors. But they would never, and if they did, if I ever got a direction from one of my mayors, not to respond to a police emergency,
right,
not to respond to criminal activity, I would very simply have not complied with that direction. And I would deal with the circumstances afterwards. And if it cost me my career, well, you know, so what? I didn't do anything wrong with Laquan McDonald, and it still goes through my career. But by the same token, I think it's really borderline malfeasance, and I've said this publicly a few times now, when elected officials are telling us how to do what we do and what not to do. And you cannot tell us to not enforce the law. We take oaths just like they do, but, you know, maybe we mean ours more than they mean theirs, because my values do not comport with the politics of Illinois today. I would never, ever, ever drive past a police car that was doing a car stop, not slow down and get a thumbs up from the officer who was there. I do that today. I did it this morning on 294 coming to work. So if somebody's calling for help, I don't care if it's Department of Homeland Security or the United States Marines. I would be personally responding along with whatever resources I could bring to the table. And I think what happened here is something that Governor Pritzker touts as the Trust Act, which is an incredibly poorly written directive. And it tells us that law enforcement in the state of Illinois will not assist federal authorities with administrative arrests. Now, if there's a crime being committed, that's a whole different issue. And I think that there was some confusion here. And when they called for help, the cops went. I mean, there's, you know, I saw Larry Snelling on TV talking about the fact that 27 officers were exposed to tear gas. And, you know, I also heard that there's audio from the officers saying, we can't leave because I'm boxed in. So what happened was the officers automatically responded, and then the direction came, we're not going to help them. And right. I think that's because of the confusion in the way that the Trust Act is written. But by the same token, what are we talking about here? You know, whether it's administrative or not, there's laws. There's immigration laws. And we can't pick and choose which laws we want to comply with. You know, criminals don't comply with robbery. They think it's okay to stick up a bank or a John Q. Citizen on the street.
Right.
And what? How are we supposed to know as law enforcement what's going on? And let's say, you know, here I am sitting in Willow Springs. Let's say Hodgkins has something going on right next door. You know, we're going to respond. Yeah. We're not going to know what it is until after the event is over. And the emergency call should be responded to automatically, like CPD actually did. And then at the end of the day, got recalled from. And by the way, this is beyond anything I ever imagined in my 44 years of law enforcement, that we're actually having a conversation about whether or not we're going to help other law enforcement agencies. It's beyond. I can't imagine it.
Crazy times, Gary. Just bizarre. The Trust Act. You nailed it right there. I don't think most people realize. You know, they hear a lot about the Safety Act, but I don't think they realize what the Trust Act is. You know, entails and makes puts that in place for your department. I mean, you guys obviously have to follow the state laws, but you would respond because that's who you are. What the law says, and correct me if I'm wrong, that local law enforcement can't do anything to help in any such way or be seen to be maybe helping federal law enforcement in any actions, that all their energy has to be spent locally, essentially.
No, it really doesn't. That's what I'm saying, Jeff. It's so poorly written. Even the people who wrote it don't understand what they said.
It's dangerous.
That's a problem. Yeah.
Yeah, don't you think? And the short story is, you know, we are, as per the Safety Act, which I can't even say this out loud, we're allowed to enforce the law.
Yeah.
But we're not allowed to help them in administrative functions. And, you know, illegal immigration, apparently, on some level, is considered administrative. If they have a criminal warrant, we can assist them. If there's riots and assaults going down, we can assist them. And then, you know, you've got people, like I said, I think it's borderline malfeasance when somebody like Brandon Johnson is saying, okay, federal authorities cannot use city properties to stage for events that they're going to take. And the two things that people have to realize, and I just got an in-depth briefing on this just this week. Anybody that you see in camouflage uniforms, it's not ICE. That's Border Control, 99.9% of the time. ICE is out there in plain clothes with targeted enforcement looking for individuals. Border Control are the ones who, I think, we see firing pepper balls and so on and so forth. And I want to make it clear that I'm not impressed nor happy with their crowd control techniques. And, you know, this harkens back to what we did in NATO in 2012. And I've given Larry Snelling and CPD props for what they did at the Democratic National Convention. And if you look at the video of what happened last week, you see where the Illinois State Police showed up and Cook County Sheriff showed up. And I want to give props to both of those organizations. They're great organizations, especially with Leo Schmitz running Cook County Police. They showed up. They were organized. You can see them all in formation. It didn't look like a riot. And unfortunately, I don't think that Border Control is trained in proper techniques to do crowd control. And this,
Right.
you know, I have to go back to a quick war story, which was leading up to the 2012 NATO summit. I remember going to a community meeting and a woman said to me, "Are you going to use tear gas to control the crowd?" And I said, "Only if you can explain to me how tear gas would control a crowd rather than taking a crowd of 1,000 people and splitting it up into 10 100-person crowds going in different directions."
Right.
So what tear gas does is it kind of fosters disorder. It doesn't help in what we're talking about here. And, you know, you watch the techniques that they've been using, and it's totally inappropriate in my mind. And I'm really glad the state police and Cook County Sheriff's Police have stepped in, because they know what they're doing. They know how to do it. And
they should have gone to the Gary McCarthy pre-NATO school. Do you have one?
No, there's no school for that. That was all on the fly, John. We made it up as we went on. That's not really true, but the amount.
Yeah, yeah, right. You laid out your experience. I'm sure you run into that over the years and trained a good school or a skill set, a toolkit to kind of keep things down. Obviously, I mean, we live through it here. There weren't too many major riots in Chicago under the McCarthy watch.
Well, you know what, Jeff? I just want to add something to that, because you really just hit on a point that nobody seems to realize. You know, we in policing for years now, we talk about crime statistics. And if you think back to the 70s and 80s, we didn't really hang our hat on that until the early 90s, when we started trying to prevent crime rather than just responding to it. You could tell people that crime is down, but if the perception of disorder is out there, they are just not going to believe it.
Yeah.
And I want you to think about the fact that, you know, we had the Floyd riots. I can't get the pictures out of my head of the Columbus statue in Grant Park and that event where the officers were just under attack. I mean, you know, that was Custer's last stand, quite frankly, with Sitting Bull.
Hit in the head by a bottle of ice thrown by, what, a teacher? Who did that? Who, you know, we don't know, because they weren't arrested. Yeah.
But you take that, you couple it with the disorder of the, oh, I love this term, the teen takeovers. You know, it sounds cute. You know, I'm going to bring my 9-year-old to the next one that I find.
We did when I was a kid. Yeah. They were called lock-ins, and
you know what they are, Jeff? They're mob actions,
right,
which is criminal activity. People see this and it scares them. The other thing that's going on across the country, not just in Chicago, is the fact that with the politics of today, we've abandoned things like quality of life enforcement. And, you know, the 10 gangbangers who were standing on the corner of 82nd and Drexel all night drinking Hennessy and selling dope or doing whatever they're doing, everybody who lives in that community becomes a victim to that offense, because they see it, they cross the street, they walk around the corner, and they avoid it. Quality of life enforcement, or lack thereof, affects the perception of order, law and order, and crime. So, you know, I'm happy to hear that CPD talks about the fact that we don't want the National Guard in Chicago, which, by the way, I would resist if I was superintendent, and maybe it's just my pride. But by the same token, the reason they say that is because they've got the lowest murder rate since 2014. Do you guys remember who was the superintendent in 2014? So, and I like to say that, you know what? Yeah, we did okay. In 13 and 14, we had the lowest murder rates since 1965, but we still had more than 400. And that's just not cool.
Sure.
So it was progress, not success. So there's a lot going on there that people don't realize, whether it's quality of life enforcement, whether it's these mob actions, whether it's the vehicles spinning around in the middle of intersections.
Right.
I mean, this is all affecting the public perception and the fear of crime. And to their credit, when Bill Bratton and Rudy Giuliani came to New York City, the mantra for the NYPD became very simple. We're going to reduce crime and the fear of crime. That's not happening today, based upon the politics. The other thing that's not happening is data-driven policing, because they keep taking away the data. They eliminated the gang database, which is how we reduced the murder rate in 13 and 14. Just FYI.
With over three decades of serving up streetwise insight and local perspective on Page 2, the voice of John Cass has a home at johncassnews.com, a place where common sense is still served daily.
Listen up. You like being treated as a chumbalone, as a fool, sitting on a stool, smiling wanly at the sky?
Don't be a chumbalone and subscribe at johncassnews.com.
I'm John Cass, 40 years a newspaper man in Chicago. I won't name the place. It's just the paper now.
That's the Chicago way.
But I'm asking you to join me so you can get a decent cup of common sense, at least. You're not going to get it from the media. It's time that you join the frontier of independent journalism at johncassnews.com.
Don't get caught in the parade of chumbalones.
Traditional media, mainstream media like the paper, they're all in on it. They think you're stupid. You know what they think? They think you're a chumbalone.
Subscribe at johncassnews.com now for only $50 a year and become a member of the No Chumbalone Zone.
Did you guys have, when you were superintendent, did you have gang crime Southwest and North?
We had it divvied up into, there was geographical accountability that didn't exist before. So that, you know, we had these two big task forces when I got here.
Right.
I forget the names of them right now, but I broke those up, and because they were on the south side one day, west side the next, and they could have been downtown if there was a keen takeover, if you will.
Yeah.
There was no geographical accountability. Then I broke everything up into three sections. We had North, Central, and South, and the deputy chiefs would have some resources that they could dump into, say, the 6th district if it got hot, or they could dump them into the 11th or the 15th on the west side. So geographical accountability, but that went across the board. That went for gang crimes, narcotics, detectives, and patrol. So everybody's working in the same neighborhoods all the time, and you get to tell the difference between the 5 kids who were always standing on that corner versus the 5 kids who were coming from basketball practice on the other one.
Right. An important distinction.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's what's more community policing than that. I mean, if you're part of the community, right? That's,
yeah, well,
that's
Jeff,
what I was, you know, clamor for.
Yeah. And well, so let me get this out first. That when I got here, I like to say that we had three different departments. We had the IDU enforcement police, which are those task forces. We had I Make People Feel Good Police, which was CAPS, and we'd go to meetings and talk to people about what's going on. And then we had I Answer the Radio Police, and they would just handle calls for service. And there was never enough officers on beats to handle the jobs. There was no such thing as beat integrity. They would send you from one side of a district to the other to handle a non-priority job. Takes you 20 minutes to get there, 20 minutes to handle it, and 20 minutes to get back to your beat. That's an hour that you're out of your beat, and it made no sense. So geographical accountability, you know, McCarthy and Cash working in a beat car every single day will get to know what the conditions are in those beats, get held accountable for them, and could do all three of those things. We could do, I handle the radio police, I do enforcement police, and I do community policing all at the same time.
But what about resources now? Because, and you're not responsible for this, you're in Willow Springs taking care of your town where you're being paid. But in Chicago, I read wire points, and I'm sure you've looked at it too, Gary and Jeff.
Yeah.
And what wire points is all about data, and just right up Gary's alley. And their data says that there were 56%. Wait, let me get this straight. Of all the 911 calls, 56% weren't responded to because they didn't have enough cops. 56%. What's going on?
Well, there's two things, John. First of all, I determined when I was here, when I was in Chicago, that we were handling too many calls for service. I'm sorry, we're not responding to a cat in a tree, but yeah. Yet people would call us.
Jeff.
You know, we are the government's last resort, right? When people need help, they call 911, and those jobs get dispatched. So right. I cut down on the number of calls that we were going to that were not police-related public safety calls, quite frankly. You know, we've lost our way in that we forgot that it's called law enforcement. That's what we're supposed to do. We enforce the law. So the other thing that goes along with that is the fact that the dispatchers do not even work for the police department. They work for OEMC. And they operate under something called a clean screen, which results in what I talked to you about already, which is Cassim McCarthy might be in beat 912, but by the same token, we're going to get sent up the other end of the 9th District, which is a pretty large district, to handle a non-priority job just so the dispatcher can have a clean screen. No, hold that job for whoever that beat car is when they become available. It makes no sense the way that we do things. And when I always ask the question, why do we do that? I always got the same answer, which is the worst one in the world, because that's the way we've always done it.
Sure.
So, but here's the kicker that really disturbs me is there was, when I left, and I'm not blaming CPD for this, I'm blaming the politics of the time, everything that we implemented really got pushed away. And, you know, when we were having such success in 2013 and 14, people would say to me, you know, things are going pretty well. You got a lot of progress going on. And I would say, yeah, but I'm not calling this success. They would say, how long is it going to take before you can institutionalize these changes that you've put in place? I said, well, culture is a hard thing to change. I think it's probably going to take at least 3 or 4 more years unless we go back to politics as usual. And what happened? We went right back to it. And it was articulated on the fifth floor of 35th Street by more than one or two people that we're not going to do that New York anymore. And I said, okay. So we're not going to try and stop people from getting killed. We're just going to do what we do because that's how we do it. And that was the politics. And then I hate to do this, but I'm going to say it. When Lori got elected, the simplest things like the gang database, way that we had success was by preventing the retaliation shootings. So that if Gary McCarthy is a red hot chili pepper and I get shot in my red hot chili pepper turf, we know that the retail is going to happen with the rival gang. And we wouldn't send everybody to the scene. We would send them to where the retaliation was going to take place. And to do that, you have to have the data. It kind of reminds me of baseball. You have to know what you're going to do with the ball before it gets hit to you. You're going to throw the third, you're going to throw the second, you're going to throw from the out, whatever. And that's exactly what we were doing. And we were preventing the retaliation shootings were happening within 4 to 6 minutes. Think about how quickly that is. You know, a guy gets shot here and another guy gets shot there. And that's where we had our success. And we were only able to do that because we took the time to identify as many gang members as we could identify in the city, what gangs they were in, what the turfs were, and who they were in conflict with. So that when the conflict rose up, we were able to respond to it in a preventative fashion for the next shooting. And what happens? They eliminated the gang database. you know, it's like taking away ShotSpotter. Brandon Johnson is a guy who can't speak 3 sentences without saying black and brown people. Yet what he did was he took resources away from black and brown people. ShotSpotter is not on Michigan Avenue. ShotSpotter was on the west side and the south side of Chicago, where black and brown people are getting shot all the time. And he took it away. Why? I don't know. I can't imagine. I can't imagine why they eliminated the gang database. They talk about, you know, civil liberties and so on.
You know, when you mentioned the confusion of these police agencies to deal with the law under crisis, you talked about badly written orders. I'd suggest that one of those laws, confusing laws, were written, let's say, Kwame Raoul, the attorney general, who really doesn't write them, but let's put him in the spot. He's typing. And then leaning on his left shoulder is, of course, Tony Preckwinkle. And the right shoulder is her buffoon that she created, Brandon Johnson. And they're both chiming in, telling them what to do, how to do it, how to thwart the Chicago police and law enforcement. And I think that's what we're seeing all over the place.
Yeah, and that's why I started with politics affecting policing across the country.
Yeah,
I was aghast when I went to the Major City Chiefs Association conference probably about 4 years ago after my time out, I'd like to call it, from policing. And they were talking about 85% of their conversation was talking about DEI. And I was like, what is going on here? You know, 5 years ago, we would wake up in the morning, go to breakfast and say, hey, John, how you doing? You know, my murders are up, but my robberies are down. So I think I'm doing. No, John, how are you doing? Oh, yeah. No, I'm okay. And we talk about crime all day. Then we'd go to lunch. We'd sit around and talk about crime. Then we'd go and you know, have a happy hour before dinner, and we'd talk about crime and crime and crime. And that's how we came up with these best practices, which were collected. And I'm going to give some credit here to the Obama administration, the 21st Century Conference on Policing. They put together the best practices from across the country, which we participated in as CPD. And guys like Charlie Beck and Bill Bratton, Chuck Ramsey, Kathy Lanier, Ed Davis, remarkable minds in policing were doing remarkable things. And Obama pulled together this all these various different practices, like sociologists and scientists and social workers, and put us all together and came up with best practices. And when it was printed out and given to us, we already were doing 93% of the best practices in the country. And the other 7% were either prevented by contractual obligation or Illinois state law. And what did we do? We walked away from that. That still exists. But now, like you said, we've got the J.B. Pritzkers and Tony Preckwinkles of the world who obviously know everything about policing and how to do it better. And people are dying as a result.
Yeah. One of the things that is not being talked about is, and I worry for the underlings who get caught up in the machinery of politics and government. There was I heard, I'm sure, radio call, and the dispatcher in conversation with the chief of patrol or someone representing the chief of patrol that the cars were pulled out.
Just to confirm, at 39th Place in Kedzie, they were saying that they were being surrounded by that large crowd and they were requesting the police were not sending, waving off all the cars heading to 39th Place in Kedzie.
Again, those are the orders we're being given.
Okay, 10-4. And again, for all the units that we called to go over that way, 39th Place in Kedzie, if you could just hold on.
And I'm wondering, there was a watch commander involved in some of that discussion. And all this watch commander was doing was referencing what the orders had been from the chief of patrol.
Right.
I'm worried about that kid or that young lieutenant getting ground down in this machinery. You ever think of that kind of thing?
I think about it all the time. And the worst case scenario of what you're talking about, John, is I always point to the Adam Toledo shooting as the worst scenario and the worst response that they could ever come up with. And I have to say this, one of the things that I haven't done it recently, but for the short term after I was out of CPD, whenever an officer would get into a shooting, I would have somebody get me their number and I would give them a call. And in the case of the Toledo shooting, just to recap, it's a Tuesday night at 2 o'clock in the morning, and you've got a 13-year-old on the street hanging out with a gangbanger. He's a shorty, right? And the shorties are the young kids who are the farm system, if you will, for the gangbangers. In this case, I believe it was Latin Kings.
Right.
And the gangbanger is firing shots at somebody. It gets picked up out on ShotSpotter.
Right.
The cops respond. The gangbanger gives the gun to the shorty who runs from the police. And we've all seen the video of the foot pursuit. And in 6/10 of a second, this officer has to make a decision whether he's going to shoot or not shoot when the kid turns towards him. He shoots him and kills him.
The kid is against the fence. He can't see it. Sort of a corner. And he's like rat, and he's like cornered, the kid. And the police officer of Iraq, Afghanistan, combat veteran.
Correct.
So he's been under fire. He knows what it's about. He's not like Barney Fife showing up. And he's asking this kid to toss the gun. The kid turns quickly, doesn't give the police officer a second, turns quickly in a threatening manner. And if I were the police officer, the first thing I'm doing is firing, and I'm not firing at his hand or some other nonsense stupid that I hear from people. Why didn't you shoot his hand? You know, you don't know what you're talking about. And this poor cop was trying to stay alive, get home to his wife. Okay. Yeah. Continue.
We know the story. He fires one shot and ends up killing him. And there's actually video of him at the scene holding his head, sitting on the curb. Mm-hmm. And the guy was distraught about the actual shooting of this young man. Right. So what is the response to that? The response is we have to get rid of ShotSpotter and eliminate foot pursuits. I mean, don't try to keep that 13-year-old kid away from a gangbanger. Don't try and figure out why at 2 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday, which I believe even in Chicago is a school night, this kid is on the street with a gangbanger firing shots at somebody. Don't try to teach our children not to take a gun from a gangbanger and run from the police. Eliminate ShotSpotter, right? Eliminate foot pursuits and go after the cop who did his job. And by the way, I stayed in touch with that officer because he went through hell.
Yeah.
His wife was ill. He has a 3-year-old at the time, and he doesn't know what he's going to do. And he gets cleared by the state's attorney, who at the time was Kim Fox, which is remarkable. And then he gets cleared by the Firearms Discharge Review Board within CPD, and the police board decides that there's some sort of a violation of some sort of an internal rule, and they move to fire him. I want you to think about that for a second.
After he got through, after he was cleared by these other agencies
and
told his wife, hey, honey, I made it. We made it. We're going to keep getting paid. And then they come up with another thing. That's got to be Lori Lightfoot, I think.
Well, it's entirely possible, John. But here's the addendum to this whole story. I actually called him last week because I haven't spoken to him in a long time. Mm-hmm. And I was like, how are you doing? He says, well, you know, I'm doing great. I'm actually out here with my daughter and we're planting flowers and blah, 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 blah. I was like, oh, that's great. I said, you know, aren't you glad this all of this stuff is over? He says, what do you mean? I said, you know, it's all good, right? He goes, no, it's still ongoing. They're challenging his disability pension or his pension, whatever it is. They have not let this guy off the hook yet, holding him accountable for all those things that were wrong that night. It's unconscionable. Why would you become a police officer if this is what you would be subject to? Now, mind you, I'm so dense that if I write a book, it's probably going to be something along the lines of, if I could do it all over again, I'd do it all over again. But why would young people today want to get involved in something like that? The politics, certainly of Illinois, and the politics across this country are ruining one of the most noble professions on earth.
What is the result of that ruination for the citizen?
You get more crime. You get less responsive. How can we allow these teen takeovers, mob actions to occur without coming in with the orange netting and locking up every single one of them? It's beyond comprehension for me. And at this point, I guess I'm an old guy, right? Because I went on the job in 1981. And I like to say when I got to the 4-6 precinct in the Bronx, they were happy if you showed up for work. And if you were sober, it was even better. And, I saw the professionalism of my profession go through the roof.
Right.
All of a sudden, in the early 1990s, basically with the election of Rudy Giuliani and bringing in a Bill Bratton, the professionalism of my department went through the roof. Suddenly, uniform appearance mattered. Suddenly, the training was great. We got better uniforms with the sharp looking sweaters. We went to 9mm, and we decided that we were going to prevent crime, not just respond to it and pick up shell casings and bodies. And it caught on. And I'm so proud that I was there at that time and that eventually I took over the mantle of running New York's crime strategy for 7 years. We know how to do this, and we're not being allowed to do it. We're not being allowed to do it because of the politics of today. And it's unconscionable that people are dying as a result of that in the name of, I don't know what, civil liberties? No, it's not civil liberties. It's the enforcing of the law.
Can we just get to the constant whine is all about one thing. They don't want African Americans and Latinos in jail. And they run their politics on screaming about law enforcement to protect them, to protect the repeat offenders from being institutionalized. Tell me I'm wrong.
You're not wrong. And I'm going to reinforce it. I'll stop and I'll do this as quickly as I can.
Please do.
But you take the whole controversy of a quote unquote stop and frisk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When I was superintendent, New York exploded with that controversy with the ACLU. And the whole controversy is you're disproportionately stopping African Americans. So stop and frisk is actually stop, question, and frisk. And it's based upon a 1968 Supreme Court finding where they said that we could stop people based upon articulable, reasonable suspicion. The ACLU and the Department of Justice at the time changed that, not by policy, but by practice, to say that we're disproportionately stopping African Americans. If we stop people based upon population demographics, in other words, Chicago is roughly a third, black, white, and Hispanic, let's say. If we stop 30% white folks in Englewood, first of all, there's only a couple of white guys there.
That's my old neighborhood.
It would do nothing about crime, but it would also be unconstitutional. So we're being held to a standard that conflicts with the Supreme Court finding
by design.
Right. And we did a 2-year analysis of crime in 2013 and 14. And it turns out that in every one of the 77 communities across Chicago, while we had the lowest crime rates in the city since the mid-60s, within 1% or 2%, who we stopped, when we stopped, and where we stopped was within 1 or 2% of offender description by victim. Think about that. You get robbed by a white guy and we stop black guys, we got a problem.
Right.
And arrest. Data-driven policing put us in a place where it wasn't about arresting everybody. It was about arresting the right person at the right place at the right time for the right reason. And that's exactly what we did. And the results bore out the success of that. And that's been abandoned. It makes no sense at all. If you don't like the laws, change the laws. But don't tell us that we're violating the law when we're following the law. When DOJ decided they were coming to Chicago, the press comes to me and they said, well, what do you think they're going to find? I said, they're going to find systemic racism. They're going to find poor training and poor supervision. And he said, well, why do you say that? I said, because that's what they found in the other 25 investigations that they've done during the Obama administration.
Right. That's what they want to find. Right.
They make their decisions. They come to town. They take testimony and say, aha, we knew it. They didn't interview. They didn't interview me. That was one of my favorite parts of that. When Loretta Lynch came to unveil the results of the investigation, she talked about the fact that they interviewed, you know, more than 1,000 people and this, that, and the other thing, which if you do the math, they interviewed 0.0003% of the population of Chicago to make their findings. And the press said, hey, did you interview Gary McCarthy? And she said, and I quote, we tried to interview Mr. McCarthy, but he was unavailable.
Where were you at? On the tarmac? Were you sitting on the tarmac where she had her meeting with Bill Clinton about?
I was at 411 West Ontario Street in River North. So naturally the press comes to me, and being the wise guy I am, they said, is that true? And I said, so you're telling me with all the investigative resources of the federal government, they couldn't find me here in River North?
Yeah.
And they were standing outside my apartment building. The press knew where I was. Everybody knew where I was. That was simply a lie. And that's what's going on. It's unbelievable.
So bottom
line, I
got to
tell you something. I'm so glad that my dad is not alive.
Oh,
World War II Marine, got shot 3 times for this country. Came back, became a police officer, greatest generation, went right back to work like nothing happened. And if he saw what was happening, his regiment raised the flag on Mount Suribachi.
Oh,
and if he saw what was going on today, he would be turning in his grave.
My father, too. So bottom line, Gary, I don't want to be partisan here, but I have to ask you, if Chicago continues to elect Brandon Johnson or continues to elect Tony Preckwinkle, will anything change in terms of crime and law enforcement and the rule of law and the feeling of safety that people have? Or will it continue to
spiral out of control?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. One of my favorite sayings is, if you always do what you always did, you'll always get what you always got. It's that simple. You know, and to this day, John and Jeff, you know, I get stopped by people all over the place. And I want you to think about the fact that I got here in May of 2011. And probably since that day, at least 10 people a day stop and talk to me, honestly. And to this day, it's still happening. I want you to do the math on how many people that is. And I've met 4 knuckleheads who complained. But everybody else says the same thing to me today. They say, man, you got thrown under the bus. And I say, well, why do you think that happened? And they said, well, because somebody had to pay, and that's what we always do. And I say, well, how's that working out? And they say, not so good. I mean, people know it. So it's never going to change if somebody doesn't change it. And to her credit, my wife, Kristen, always told me, she said, Gary, it's never going to change. And I said, it's not going to change unless somebody changes it. And I did the best I could. We had success. We didn't get everything right. No two ways about it. But by the same token, we had a lot of progress. And, you know, the year after I got fired, the murder rate went up to 767. when we had it down to about 4 on 9. Who's paying for that? Right? Mm,
no. The same people that they pretend to care about.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Oh,
it's not John. It's not John Cass and Betty Cass living out in St. John, Indiana, where I had to run to feel safe, where I can go to the Walgreens without having a stick on me to get my insulin. It's the black and brown people who are being murdered, and they don't care because they want their hands clean, but their hands are bloody.
Yeah. Yeah. And unfortunately, this it's so complicated. And the white liberals, I consider myself a moderate. Most would say that I'm probably not, but I consider myself a moderate. Yeah. They contribute to it. You know, some people have never been punched in the face. And I love the Chris Rock thing on that. He says, people say words hurt. Words hurt. Well, anybody who says words hurt ain't never been punched in the face.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know how we make folks wake up and just and why can't we have conversations instead of cancel culture?
Yeah.
Before we go, I got to ask you one thing. Your former town that you loved besides Chicago was New York, and it's about to elect a communist mayor who hates the police. How's that going to work out, Gary?
It's not. It's just not. And, you know, as somebody said to me last week, the best thing that could happen in this country is that guy does get elected, because New York will fail and then people might start to figure it out. And I hope that isn't the case. Right? They say that you have to hit rock bottom before you can pick yourself up. I don't think that's really true. I like to learn from other people's mistakes and not make my own.
Well, they're not learning from ours.
No.
We tried to tell them, and they're not listening. So, you know, because New York never thinks Chicago knows what it's doing. But we were front. We were in the first, and they should have seen what was happening. Gary,
John, just really quick, and this is not to counter what you just said, but there's different places across the country that have had success. And like I said, we collected that. We put it all together. I didn't come up with all the strategies that we used when I got here. I took them from other places like Los Angeles. We know how to do this. We just refuse to do it. I can't make that any clearer. And it doesn't matter if it's New York, Chicago, St. Louis, Los Angeles, Houston, Philadelphia. It doesn't matter. We're all in the same place right now. And it's horrible.
We're the descent unto the maelstrom, circling the drain.
Yeah.
Gary McCarthy, thanks for joining us on this Chicago Way.
Always a pleasure, guys. I have a lot to say. Thank God, and I still have a voice.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you. Be good.
For Gary McCarthy, former police superintendent, when the murder rate was low in Chicago, now currently at Willow Springs. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer, WGN Radio, my friend, future physics teacher, baker of pies, unfortunately, lover of cats. And for me, John Cass, editor-in-chief, or publisher, if you will, of johncassnews.com, $50 a year, and you get all the common sense I can give, two exclusive columns and podcasts each week. Thanks for joining us on this edition of the Chicago Way Podcast on WGN+.